Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Ultra Hope Girls at Danganronpa Podcast. In this episode, we are going to be going through Chapter 3 of Ultra Despair Girls and just diving deep into that. But with that, we want to let you guys know that some of the things we talk about are going to focus around sexual assault and rape. And if that is something that is not healthy for you to listen to, please skip over this episode. That is totally fine. And we look forward to seeing you in our next episode release. If you feel unsafe in your home, if you are looking for help, you can call the National Human Trafficking Hotline at 1-888-373-7888. And if you feel that you want to talk to someone about sexual assault, or if you feel that you have been assaulted, please call 800-656-4673. And we here at the Ultra Hope Girls are sending you love and sending you support. And yeah, we're here for you. But just so you know, this episode will spoil through Chapter 3, Ultra Despair Girls. And with that, let's get going.
I'm Maddie.
I'm Marin.
And I'm Caroline.
And we're the Ultra Hope Girls.
1, 2.
Welcome to the Danganronpa Podcast.
You're on the threshold of an amazing episode. Showtime.
All right, squad. Welcome back to another episode of Ultra Hope Girls, a Danganronpa Podcast.
Woo-hoo.
Yeah, baby. We're covering probably one of the most hard to get through chapters in Danganronpa as a series as a whole, which is Chapter 3 of Ultra Despair Girls.
Yeah, this is definitely the chapter that I was, I think, least looking forward to replaying throughout the entire series. So,
yeah. Yeah, I feel you there. This is the chapter that almost made me stop playing this game entirely when I was like first playing it. We'll get to that later, but like I came very close to putting it down and never coming back to it.
I think that the creators of Danganronpa definitely pushed the boundaries in terms of what they include in their video games, and they definitely did not stop here. I don't know, in some ways I respect that, and in other ways I'm, you know, like, it was hard to get through, but I think that's the point is the message yeah. that I got.
So the first thing that happens in this chapter is I have my first note that Kamaru is on a Zoom call with Makoto. And, you know, isn't that just topical? But, you know, so they're at the top of this tower and Toko's kind of like cowering in the corner because she doesn't want Makoto to see her at first. And, you know, she's acting really weird. But one thing that I couldn't help but notice is that Makoto's face and like the kind of green screen that he's behind on that laptop remind me of Alter Ego from Trigger Happy Havoc a lot. And so because of that, did anyone else wonder or like question whether that was actually Makoto?
Oh, I didn't at all. I really thought it was him because at this point, this game is so brutal that I was like, if he is like fake or dead, that's it. I'm signing off.
Yeah, I definitely did think it was him, but I did also think that he had changed since we saw him. And I don't know if it's because we're not within his head anymore. You know, like, I don't know if what's going on in there is similar to what we saw in the first game, but he seems like exactly like Kamaru was saying, like, I don't know. He just seems more confident and he seems like he might have gotten a little like flack for being so positive. Like he makes a joke about like being positive is my only good trait. And it was just like a more relaxed, likable version, I think, of Makoto. I don't know if you guys felt similarly, but.
Yeah, I had a note that says Makoto, quote, being positive is my only good point. And I was like, oh, at least he's self-aware.
I wrote under that line, I wrote, this line was written by Caroline.
No, he's fine. I had a question about this too, is like, why didn't Toko fill Kamaru in on everything that happened?
Right?
Why? I don't really understand. And Makoto, like, in response says, like, he's not that surprised that she didn't, but like, do you guys have any theories as to why she would have done that?
I think probably to avoid the conversation of prioritizing Byakuya, because I think that if Toko had said, oh, I'm part of Future Foundation, I knew your brother a long time ago, you know, like, I knew Byakuya, she'd be like, cool, can you contact them? Let's get out of here. Or she... Toko has pretty much been pulling Kamaru along throughout the city, and like we've seen, like when they were on the bridge, she was really, really hesitant to leave. And I think giving away any information that would suggest that she could get them a way out of there would be detrimental to saving Byakuya.
That makes a lot of sense, actually.
Yeah, that's valid. I was gonna say maybe it's literally just because Toko is really bad at communicating, but yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And we definitely like see like this level of commitment to Byakuya when she like is threatens to like kill Kamaru.
Yeah.
Oh my god. I was like, oh man, like
yeah. And I had a note about that as well. And my it's just a question to pose to the group. Did you guys think that Toko meant it when she said that?
Yes. I think it would have hurt her a lot if she had actually had to go through with that. But she's known Kamaru for about, what, 3 days? And she is in love with Byakuya. Up for debate.
But... well, she is in love with Byakuya.
Yeah, she would definitely say she's in love with Byakuya. And also, like, kind of along that pathway, I had a question in here about, like, which of the two would you really agree with? Like, is it so horrible for Kamaru to... request to like get transport out, like is it like is Toko being selfish or selfless by asking Kamaru to stay in order to try and save Byakuya?
I mean, I think I just watched like a movie about this about oh no it was this game that we were playing. Okay. This is a theme that kind of comes up like a lot in this chapter. I feel like later when Haiji is like, how can we do the most with like the least amount of people being in harm's way? And I think that personally that's kind of the thought process I was thinking with Toko, because she we see later in this chapter she has just like really matured a lot and is a lot more like self-aware than she used to be. And so I think maybe her thought process was less like, oh, like for my own selfish needs, and more like, well, if we save Byakuya then they can come and there's less people who are in harm's way in theory. You know, because Kamaru has the hacking gun, even though she says she's a useless high school girl, which Marin and I will rant about to great lengths in this episode today. You know, she's proved herself up to this point to be capable of handling herself in this terrain. And so I think, one, it shows Toko's like faith in Kamaru in some ways, like that maybe they can do both.
Yeah, I mean, that's really well put. I don't know if I honestly have anything else to add.
Yeah.
I agree with that, Caroline.
Thank you.
When I looked at it, like, from a broader step back, Kamaru's solution of getting Future Foundation to come pick them up, that saved only Kamaru, because I would imagine Toko would stay behind. So let's say that saves just Kamaru, whereas Toko's version of how to handle things had the potential to save all three, you know, Kamaru, Toko, and Byakuya. And so, like, yes, while it was partially selfish because she had a personal connection to Byakuya, if it had been Makoto, I don't know if she'd be acting the same way, to be completely frank. Or, like, Hiro, I guess, would be a better example, because then Kamaru doesn't have a personal connection. But I think her solution had the best chance of saving the most people. So... I don't know. I was kind of... Actually, no, I'm not even going to lie. I was very on Toko's side.
It's hard not to be with the two of them, honestly. Like, I feel like it's not... There's no debate there.
So we get filled in on, like, the whole past, the past... Like, the first game, and then kind of, like, the end of the second game, like, kind of, you know, talking about the remnants of despair and stuff like that. But I noticed that once Junko's name was mentioned in that beginning Zoom call, as Maddie said, Junko began to appear in different parts of the scene throughout the rest of the game. Like, it was a lot more obvious, I think, than in the first two chapters, specifically in Jotaro's artwork, which they had a couple additional paintings this round. I know, I think it's the last episode I mentioned that there's a painting of Monica and of Kotoko, and in this one there was an additional mural that was of Jotaro and Junko in The Princess and the Frog, which was super interesting because like one of the main lessons that you get from The Princess and the Frog is that like the best pairings in life come by two people who encourage one another and promote the best traits in one another versus like forcing someone to change, which is I think exactly what Jotaro wants in someone, is someone who doesn't want him to change but wants to like uplift him for, you know, who he was or is. Is he dead? I don't think we know if he's dead.
We don't know.
Yeah, so that was kind of interesting. And then I mentioned last time that Kotoko has the Cinderella mural, which like Caroline, I think you might know a little bit more about like the Cinderella story and that.
Yeah, I can talk about it. I mean, yeah, it's really interesting, you know, like they have her painted as Cinderella. And I was just thinking of like the connections that that could hold, which are like, you know, Cinderella, like, it grew up in a household with only women, but they were women who forced her to like basically be nobody and like be like a servant for their family. And there are some connections there, like her mother was the only figure present in her life. Like we learned that her father kind of was off like having an affair with his receptionist or whatever. Her mother inevitably was the one who, you know, exposed her to these horrible things when she was so young, similarly to like Cinderella's stepmother. You know, there's not much of a comparison there with the level of horrible, but like both were pretty abusive moms, you know. And so I kind of interpreted it as like, you know, Cinderella like gets blessed. Cinderella gets like magicked up by the fairy godmother, and then like she's beautiful and she's like on display and on stage for the ball, but then after hours, once midnight hits, that's all over, and then the horrible reality comes back. And so it's like kind of like Kotoko and how she, you know, is the ultimate actress and she's like sparkling on stage, but then, you know, the darker side of like, it's like the double-sided coin of the, you know, double life kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, which we know one other person who has a double life, which may come up later.
Hannah Montana.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but Cinderella is like you said, like I saw online in like kind of a summary of the themes of Cinderella is that all of her value is found in her like femininity, you know, which is I think really similar to Kotoko, and also just kind of speaks volumes to Jotaro's artwork. Giving him a shout out, the fact yeah. that he's finding these themes and painting them on the walls, I'm like, all right buddy, good for you.
Shout out to Jotaro for making his dioramas, you know.
Yep.
we don't stand the ones made of human bodies, but these ones are just like cardboard or whatever, so yeah, it's yeah. all good. I had another kind of comment that's like sort of related, and it's also about like the time when Makoto's kind of filling us in on like Junko and how everything happened there. And it's just the fact that like the way that Junko is explained and like depicted in that scene is like she's like literally a religious figure, because it's like, oh well, she had all these followers and like she had this like ideology that she was promoting, which was despair, right? And then after her death, her followers increased in number and in power, you know, like after she was dead. And that is like, you know, kind of like a very, how do I say this?
It's like a martyr.
Yeah, like she was a martyr for a cause, or like a prophet, or like kind of, you see, there are a lot of, I mean, Jesus is only one of the many examples of like, you know, religious history of like the founder or the figure behind the religion. It only really becomes like, I don't want to say mainstream, but becomes much more powerful and takes off like after that person's death, which I just thought was interesting.
To connect that sort of to like, this is a very different example, but like when I think of that, that idea of someone dying and then it's like they're the symbol of who they are, like almost ascends who they actually were in life is yeah. like Joan of Arc. Like when I think of Joan of Arc, I think of like queer, like maybe gender queer, because she's been depicted in a lot of works where like people have played around with gender and, you know, and how she was like a symbol for that, even though like, you know, she was a woman of God, her beliefs were, you know, Christian, but like, you know, a lot of pop culture has changed what Joan is, or, you know, it's like Joan of Arc who died is like a different than the Joan who we see depicted in pop culture. It's like a different, yeah, like her essence is bigger than her in a way.
Yeah, yeah. It takes on a life of its own, like the idea of a person, like after. My next note is about Celeste's cat.
Go for it.
It's not really like that deep. It's just that we like find out Celeste's person, quote unquote person, that was most important to her was her cat. And oh gosh, what was the cat's name? Does anyone have it written down?
I do. Her cat's name was Grand Boy Sherry Ludenberg.
An icon.
That's so good.
It's funny.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was gonna say it's funny too because, you know, we learned that like a potential unused motive was like the family members being pitted against each other, and I'm like, how would the cat fare in that? Like, how would that happen?
Isn't Tokos like a stink bug?
Yes. Yes.
That's it iconic. Is. So then we flash to our dear gals, Kotoko and Monica, who are, you know, bored of a funeral. So they're, you know, just hanging out. And we basically learn that Kotoko was prostituted and raped, which was alluded to earlier. But now, like, there's some things I can bring up that were references earlier in the game that now make sense because we know this of her past. So we learn that Kotoko prefers unpeeled chestnuts, and I thought that the sword probably is an innuendo to, you know, circumcised versus uncircumcised, but also a fun fact. So in literature, a chestnut is usually a symbol of chastity, which I thought was really interesting. So I interpreted this as like one whose chestnut is peeled might have not be a virgin anymore, which is, you know, maybe why she prefers someone unpeeled. Because she views herself as like tainted, which is wrong and very sad. But yeah. And then the other reference was her preferring sweet snacks to salty ones. And another fun fact about that is that Nagito, when food is being thrown at him, he says he prefers salty snacks to sweet snacks. And I have in parentheses, he's gay. So yeah. We got to there. This is the episode for it.
Oh my. Wow.
I caught on to that when she said that earlier. She said, oh, I hate salty snacks. I was like, there is a reason why you do.
So Kotoko is not sure if Jotaro is dead, which is similar to how everyone thought post Masaru's death. But Monica again really angrily says like he's like gone, like you don't believe me, like oh my goodness. I think we really see Monica's ability to manipulate people in this chapter, because one, when they're talking about Jotaro post-death, or post-death quote unquote, because we don't know, she is still insulting him after his death, which is how he preferred to be communicated with, one can assume. And then with Kotoko, she uses her trigger word and then like beats her up so that she's not acting like how the trigger word implies. Like she is slapping her over and over. And I was like disturbed. That was I took a break after that. I was like, this is so much. Yeah. She is so manipulative.
Yeah, it was kind of disturbing.
Yeah, definitely. And it also, like, you know, the fact that Kotoko, like, it's like she prefers that over someone being, like, gentler with her. And that is sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is skipping way, way ahead, but they're in the, like, kind of boss battle at the end of this chapter with her. Kotoko says, like, when she's saying like please, like anything but gentle, like anything but gentle, she says a couple times like please hurt me instead. Like that's literally what she prefers, because you know the alternative is just so strongly associated with her trauma that she would prefer, like she'd prefer Monica to hit her in the face.
Right. I think the thing about what was done to her that is so tragic and why that's so sad is like the people who did this to her, when they were saying they were gentle with her, they were covering up their really horrible acts with that word. because of that, like, that's why it's like she just desires someone to be truthful with her, to be like, if you're hurting me, like hurt me, like tell me you're hurting me, don't just like try to pretend that it doesn't hurt me, because it does, you know, which I think Toko can relate to in a lot of ways too, in a different way. Like, she values honesty, she wants people to be honest with her. We'll get to that later.
Then we meet Kurokuma. I have no notes about him other than I don't like him.
Yeah.
Same. My only note about Kurokuma says I think he's obnoxious.
So annoying. Yeah. I think it's cool that both him and Shirakuma have female voice actors. I just think that's kind of neat. And yeah. Another thing is he does make a reference to a certain little musical called Sweeney Todd, because he talks about grinding up. So Sweeney Todd is a musical about this guy who basically like murders people with his barber razor, and then this woman makes them into pies so they get away with it, basically, and they use the human flesh as meat. It's a very good musical, but it's very disturbing, so but I highly recommend, since we're explicit, I feel okay talking about the musical. But yeah, he references that with the massacre quote that is to come, which we learn later is the infiltration of the secret base. But yeah, that was kind of cool. Love musical theater.
My next note is, quote, I simply cannot with Kamaru.
Are we beginning the roast segment now?
Shall we begin? This is in reference specifically to when, like, well, Kamara's been complaining about how Toko's not opening up. Toko, you keep so much from me. Oh my goodness, you didn't tell me you went to school with my brother. Then Toko, they're walking around and Toko says, like, hey, like, I've never told you why I'm afraid of the dark, have I? Well, and Kamaru literally says, I'll pass. Like, Kamaru literally stops her from sharing about her, like, trauma. And is complaining about it. And I was like, so mad. And then later she brings it up and she's like, you've never told me why you're scared of the dark. And I was like, girl, you and I, we don't get along.
That is the most annoying thing. Oh, okay, well, here we go.
Hit us with a Kamaru roast that you've got.
So I have a whole section entitled, I do not like Kamaru, but if you like Kamaru, that's totally valid and let's be friends. But she ranting about being normal and not having anything special, like, maybe make your own identity. Maybe just, like, make a choice and, like, be a person instead of complaining. Literally, Toko calls her out on it, like, 1,000 times, and she's using being normal as an excuse. And if she doesn't believe she can do anything, then she never will. Like, dude, you are... Oh, my God! And then, when Kamaru says about Toko that she doesn't understand what it's like to be weak, I was like, Kamaru, do not roast my son like that. That is so mean. Toko knows that she chooses to be better, unlike you, you silly girl.
Can we talk about Kamaru's favorite saying, which is, all's well that ends well? No, it's not.
That's no one's favorite saying.
It is not Kamaru's favorite saying. She has never once thought all's well that ends well. She's thought, oh, currently things are bad, I'm gonna quit. Like, no, I was so mad.
I have another segment proposition, which is, Toko is me. Because I think every episode I've come up with a quote that Toko is me. Mm-hmm. And this one is when Kamaru is asking Toko if she believes in ghosts. Y'all know the quote's coming. And she says, I may be liberal arts to the core, but I am capable of thinking logically. And I was like, I've never felt a quote more, because I'm an F on Myers-Briggs, but I'm often told that I come across as very, like, logical and rational a lot of the time. And so, yeah, I felt that in my soul.
I know, I thought of you when she said that quote. I was like, I wonder if Caroline would bring this up.
I actually took a screenshot of it.
Well,
do you if you want.
I wonder if Caroline will mention Frankenstein.
My next note is kind of a gameplay note, actually. It is just the fact that this is not my style of game, like the kind of action-y, like shooter, whatever style of game is, like, not my fave. I much prefer like kind of puzzle-based games or dialogue-based games or exploration or whatever. But I wanted to give a little shout out for like some aspects of the gameplay that like I do think were kind of good. And one of them was like, if you know, like the Pac-Man style kind of Monokuma challenges where you have to go and like...
Sorry, that's the little
exactly.
Oh, thank you, Aaron.
Precisely. where you have to like, you know, complete the objective or whatever. I didn't realize until like 2 days ago that if you fail the objective, it doesn't just like make you repeat it. It actually gives you like another version of the same kind of challenge with like a different setup and like different Monokumas, but it's like a similar thing. So you like go into a new room and there it's like different. Huh. And I don't know, I thought that was a nice touch. I thought it was cool. Like I had to give the game makers props for that, for like that creativity, because I think a lot of times when you're playing a video game and you get stuck and you keep failing this one objective, you just have to do it over and over and it's so annoying, but they kind of mix it up a little. Yeah, and also in this chapter, we get to meet the mustachioed Monokumas that like stand in a line and do that like funky kind of little dance thing out around in a circle. And I like that.
Which ones are those?
They're just Monokumas that you have to fight, but they have mustaches. And there's this one point where you like encounter them and they're standing in like a line, like one behind the other, and they start doing the wave thing and they're like...
You know what you're talking about.
It's a very small moment, but I had to shout it out.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. This next note that I have is kind of existential. So if that's not your jam, feel free to skip forward a little bit. But this kind of made me really sad. When you walk through the town and the building, the person who I'm watching play the game, their name's Nora Blue on YouTube, and they usually click on every note they find. And there are notes scattered all over this place. And the first time you pick up a note, it's like, oh man, like this is so sad. And like this person is writing their last words. These are the last dying words of these people. And it's either, I hate these kids, or my own kids betrayed me, or like, I'm so sad and I haven't done enough. But I found I was like watching the playthrough for this, when they would pick up a note and it would be about that, there was a part of me that was a little disappointed, because I was like, oh, this isn't like a reference. Like, this isn't like related to gameplay. And the fact that in 3 chapters, I'd become slightly desensitized to people's last words, their dying words, where they are professing their guilt, their grief, their distress, like that really struck me. And like, it speaks not only to desensitization of like us as a people when, you know, we see bad things, but also how similar we are to one another as humans. Because like, if you look at all of those notes, there's very similar themes in each one. And yeah, I just had a really like big moment with that where I realized.
Yeah, and it really makes you think about like what we can get desensitized to as people, like pretty much anything.
So one of the next things that we see is Monica talking with Nagisa and Kotoko. And Kotoko says something along the lines of, it's our right to kill these people, to kill these demons. And Monica says, don't you mean duty? And it's very interesting to look at how the two are viewing this differently, because we don't know what Monica's like past life trauma has been at this point. But we do, after this chapter, know Kotoko's, and hers is such a like violent, horrible trauma that she views it as like she gets permission to do this. They did something to her, and so she now has permission to do something bad in return. Whereas Monica's viewing it more as like, we need to do this, like it's our task. We like have to do this, not because we can, but because we should, and it like it must happen. And I think that's kind of interesting to look at for in the future, why that might be, to kind of look back on this moment maybe when we learn more. But yeah,
it's almost like she idolizes a certain martyr.
maybe like
a
Junko. Yeah. And then the other thing, which is right before, it's kind of before and during the meeting, is you see Shirakuma We've traveled back down. We're now back in the secret base, and we see Shirakuma, and Shirakuma's like kind of flip-flopping on what his like ideals are and what his goals are in this mission. Like, before they go talk to Haiji, he says, "You have to save the adults. You have to destroy the kid asteroid." And then later, Shirakuma's like, "But why can't we just consider talking to them?" And it kind of made me uncomfortable. Like, it was like, I don't know where Shirakuma lies in the whole thing. Yeah.
I didn't trust Shirakuma.
All right, everybody, we're going to take a quick break, but before we do you like what you're listening to today? If you do, the best way to show us your support is to give us a 5-star review in Apple Podcasts. It means the absolute world to us, and we love hearing from you guys and hearing from all of you on social media. Follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. We're Ultra Hope Girls Podcast everywhere. And if you want your question featured in the season finale of season 3, make sure you leave an audio message at anchor.fm, and we're going to get to those then. We're really excited to answer all your questions, but that's it for now. We'll be back after the break. Hello, everybody. Caroline here with a pretty exciting announcement. So I, separate from the other Ultra Hope Girls, am offering some online virtual classes in things such as writing, because, you know, I'm the ultimate literary girl, and performing, and also some clubs and classes virtually via my own school, which I founded, called the Spilling Ink School. You can check that out at thespillinginkschool.com. I'm offering tutoring and college essays. I'm offering, you know, piano classes and all that jazz. So definitely check it out. It's a good time. And I will also be offering some clubs and classes that are Danganronpa related via OutSchool. So I'll keep the links all in the description. They are for people under 18, so ask your parents before checking it out. But yeah, I'm excited to potentially have some listeners in my classes, and I wanted to let you know that that's going on. So thanks so much in advance for checking it out, and I look forward to teaching some of you. My only note before we get to, like, the attack is adult L is Jason LMAO. Because I feel like I just hear him, I know when it's him, man. He has this like specific, I don't know, lilt. And but he was doing this thing, so one thing with voice acting that, like, this is such a tangent for a second of adult L, but you know, with voice acting, like, there's a couple of different ways you can modify your voice. Like, there's pitch, there's tempo, and there's I can't think of the last one. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But it was so clear that Jason in this, you know, subliminal role was like, all right, I'm just going to talk really fast like this, and no one's going to know it's me. And that's it. But he sounds like better than that. Like, you actually understand what he's saying, but like, I could totally tell. Anyway, this is really funny.
That's awesome.
Oh, I also wanted to bring up how it's just interesting that now in this chapter, there's a conspiracy theory that the Future Foundation is behind all of it, which I thought was really interesting. My personal opinion is that, you know, I think that as an audience, we are supposed to root for Future Foundation because they are the characters that we love. You know what I mean? So, yeah, but I don't know. At this point in the game as an audience, it's, you know, I don't think most people would fall for that kind of, I don't know.
Yeah, and there's kind of the juxtaposition of, like, Toa Group and the Future Foundation, which seem to maybe be at odds, at least from, like, the kind of newspaper clippings or some of the readings that we find. Like, some of them are, you know, like you mentioned, the conspiracy theory, kind of, like, talking about, ooh, Future Foundation, they might be behind this, ooh, evil. And then we've also seen a lot of, like, notes and articles and stuff about Toa Group, like, kind of praising it as, like, the savior of the modern world, and like, oh, they invented the air filter and they made all this technology and it like saved humanity and blah 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 blah. But yeah, I do think as an audience, I agree with you, we are supposed to be rooting for Future Foundation. We know Byakuya is part of Future Foundation, so we have to root for them.
I did think it was interesting in that meeting with like adult L that all of the adults were grouping both the kids with the helmets and the Warriors of Hope as the same group. it was kind of an interesting distinction. It's just children versus adults at this point. It's not those five versus the adults. Yeah, and I didn't really, we don't get to see a lot of what's happening outside. And we learn in that meeting that the killing began when we as Kamaru left that building. That is when the killing started, which also speaks to how chaotic it is and how many murders are happening so fast. But we don't really see any of the kids hurting adults. We see them dancing around their bodies. We see them doing some questionable things, handing out riddles, giggling. But like, I don't know. From like a player, I wasn't comfortable with there being no distinction between like the ones who we have seen murder and the ones who we have not.
Right. Because technically it's the Monokumas. It's the robots that are doing all the damage.
Yeah.
Right.
So are we ready for Toko and Kamaru's big fight?
I think I am, if you guys are.
Yeah, I'm ready, dude.
The girls are fighting!
Whoa!
Mom!
When Kamaru said, "That's why you don't have any friends," I literally aloud went, whoa!
Oof. Yeah, I mean, just... But then Toko is like, oh, but I can't just leave you to run off by yourself. Like, she's like, I have to follow you. And so they're like fighting. And then Kamara's like, fine, just leave. And it's like all dramatic. But then they just like still run off together. It's like when you say goodbye to someone and then you walk in the same direction as them.
Classic.
Like, but I didn't think that was like a nice thing. Like, I didn't think it was Toko being like, but I can't leave you because I care.
No.
I think
agreed.
Yeah, it was Toko being like, I can't risk Future Foundation saving you. I gotta be ready to murder you like I promised.
Exactly. Like, yeah. I agree. I have, so my only real note about like the kind of fight that they have is a quote from Toko that I just wanted to like emphasize because it just makes me have like mad respect for her. And it's like down in the base when they're in the base and they're like talking to Haiji or whatever, and Kamaru, I think Caroline, you mentioned this earlier, when Kamaru like says like to Toko that she doesn't know what it's like to like struggle, or I don't remember exactly what she says, but then Toko responds like, I don't understand what it's like to be weak. You think I'm chosen? You must be kidding. What's so great about me, huh? I'm a walking inferiority complex. I don't have confidence. I never have. But what's going to change if I just keep saying that, using that as an excuse every day? I learned that from the killing. From the killing game, meaning that I suffered for it, but I did something about it. And like, just what growth, you know? What a queen.
I kind of have a random note, which is that we find a book in the hallway that is called "Finally, a Way to Skillfully Stack Ice Cream." And that book is about a boy who thinks he has no talent, but actually ends up having a lot of talent, which is the plot of the second game. And so I was like, what are these creators doing? Like,
You're like, hey guys, are you going to recognize this very meta reference? Like, throughout this entire game, like this chapter specifically, there are a lot of lines that's like, oh, this is as if we're playing like a video game. And I'm like, guys, like... They were in the writing room like, okay, we need like one more line for someone to say, oh, let's have them make a meta reference. Oh, great.
If we can't come up with another title option, I think "Finally, a Way to Skillfully Stack Ice Cream" could be up there.
Finally.
Finally. What we've all been waiting for years.
No woman, no cry. Because that song, Maddie, I had this rant with Marin. That song is like, is it "No Woman, No Cry"? Or is it "No Woman, No Cry"? Like, you know what I mean?
Well, we may never know.
I know, it's a mystery.
I have a question for the group. Are you ready?
I've never been more ready.
Who is the worst leader in Danganronpa, and why is it Haiji?
Yeah,
Yeah.
He doesn't do anything. He literally does nothing.
He's a figurehead. He feels like he... Yeah, totally not. Ugh. Do not like him.
Valid question, Marin.
Thank you.
Who is the worst leader? Why is it IG? Because that's the correct answer. Oh my god. After the attack, Haiji just like starts screaming at them like, oh my god, this is your fault. He is the worst. I do not like him after that. Oh my god. But yeah. He references a folk tale about a bat, you know, between a war of the birds and the beasts. And this is actually an Aesop's fable. Fun fact. And I have it pulled up. It's very short. If you would like me to just read it. Please. How's that sound? All right. A great conflict was about to come off between the birds and the beasts. When the two armies were collected together, the bat hesitated which to join. The birds that passed his perch said, "Come with us." But he said, "I am a beast." Later on, some beasts who were passing underneath him looked up and said, "Come with us." But he said, "I am a bird." Luckily, at the last moment, peace was made and no battle took place. So the bat came to the birds and wished to join in the rejoicings, but they all turned against him and he had to fly away. He then went to the beasts, but soon had to beat a retreat, or else they would have torn him to pieces. "Ah," said the bat, "I see now. He that is neither one thing nor the other has no friends." And that is the moral of this fable, because there's always a moral at the end of an Aesop's fable. And I feel like, yes, Hygie is a poopy poop face about all this whole situation, but
agreed.
I was gonna say piece of shit, but we can't.
Yes, we can. It's explicit, right?
True. Whatever. Well, you know. But I kind of got from this, like, Komaru this whole time is like, "I'm not special. I'm not chosen. I'm not this. I'm not that. I'm the other thing. I don't know. What am I?" And I'm like, sir, if you're learning anything from this folktale right now, it's that if you're not confident in who you are, you're not going to have any friends. Okay. So that's kind of what I interpreted it as. Less like, oh, you must conform to one group or another. And more like, if you don't know who you are, like, you know, it's like, you can't love someone before you love yourself, that kind of thing, like building that your identity, basically.
That also reminds me, there is a Netflix documentary called The Social Dilemma, and in it talks about how, because of social media, our brains have been altered over time to become more extremist. People are less moderate than they used to be because of social media, and because you get affirmation from saying things, liking things, doing things. And so people have become way more divided than they used to be. I highly, highly recommend watching it. It is one of the most interesting things I've watched in a long time. So highly recommend. But that like whole story reminds me of that, because it's kind of like, you can't have a moderate opinion and be accepted. Like, that speaks to our society today, that people are so much, you have to be this or you have to be that. And if you have a mixed opinion, if you're seeing things in gray, then you're out on both sides. And like that, wow, that is so interesting. Thank you for looking that up and reading it. Yeah. So when Kotoko comes into the room, she says, "Thank you very much." And that is a reference to Andrew Kaufman, who is a comedian on Saturday Night Live. He was on a couple TV shows. And he is described as a song and dance man whose willingness to promote negative and confused reactions from audiences gave him the fame that he had. That was from his Wikipedia page. Thank you, Wikipedia. That's pretty much Kotoko. Basically, like, she is kind of a song and dance woman. You know, she's been raised her entire life to be an actress. And I think a lot of her character does kind of provoke those negative and confused reactions from players. So my favorite scene in this entire chapter is when Genocide Jack is breaking out of her cell, and she goes to get the stuff from the kids, and she's being her like normal over the top self. She's like, and the kids are like shook. Like, the kids who are normally giggly, let's hand out riddles and dance around dead bodies are just like stare at her like slack jawed, like that's my favorite scene. Yeah.
Wait, but don't they have the helmets on?
Yeah, but I imagine them.
They're spiritually slack jawed.
Okay. That's the vibe. I was like, wait a second.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that scene. Yeah, she's just so great.
And when she like bends over backwards. Oh my God. I love her so much.
My next thing is the hand machine.
The worst thing in the world.
I will say this. I did say before we would get to it. This scene, was the scene where I put my laptop down. I walked away and I didn't come back to the game for like 3 days, and I really was thinking about just not finishing it. I ended up going back because I felt like I had to see it through, but like, I hated this scene. It was so uncomfortable. And like, I get why some, you know, some people would say like, oh, well, you're supposed to be uncomfortable during the scene. Like, yes, you are. And like, I don't think, what I struggle with most about this scene is, why was it necessary? Why is it in this game? Like, I honestly, I have very strong feelings about this, in case you can't tell. Like, what did that add to the plot? What did that add to the gameplay? Literally nothing, except to just be so effed up and weird. And I hated it. And I thought it was completely messed up and completely unnecessary. That's the part. I'm done ranting now.
No, so I have a big like thing, like my big point at the end is kind of about like why this chapter matters, like why it's here. And like, but I think my point could still be made if they cut that scene out, or making it something that, you know, depend, like you can either do it or you don't have to do it. Mm. That kind of thing.
That, I don't know, scene made me uncomfortable, but that was not even a slice of the life Kotoko had, because that's a machine. And so it's like, true. That made you uncomfortable. That made me uncomfortable. I think that probably made most of the players uncomfortable, but that's not even close to what she experienced. And think about how uncomfortable it made you. And she didn't get to escape from that. She didn't get to put it away for 3 days, you know? And so like, I struggled with it and I don't love it, but I get it. Like, I get what they were trying to make us feel, you know?
So I'm going to bring up my big point now, actually. This is a good segue. So the title of this chapter is called Cute Girls Battlefield. This is loaded. This is a loaded like statement here, because as women, every day is a battlefield of like fighting a lot of the points that are brought up in this chapter. And I think that I'd be curious, because I don't know any men who have played this game. And so maybe once I know men who have, I will ask. But we all three, you know, texting before this, were like, oh my God, this chapter is just awful. I hate replaying it. And I'm curious if that is because we are women, honestly, because the female experience, like knowing and being part of that, I'm sure that there are men who play this or feel uncomfortable. And I'm only basing this off of three people, you know, people's opinions here, but it's close to home for some of the things that like we have to deal with on a daily basis. Like, we're constantly told it's our fault if we wear like a slightly sexy outfit, you know, that we are the ones to blame for provoking the you know, assaulter or the whoever, if that's, you know, what we're talking about. And, you know, in my LA Business of Theater class, my teacher, who is a man, straight up told us that sex sells. So you need to find your sex appeal if you're a woman in LA. That is just how the business is. And I was like, why is that what we're selling here? And I think that that's part of the reason why this chapter makes us in particular so uncomfortable, is because we are women.
Yeah. And maybe that's something, listeners, if you're interested in talking to us about that, sharing your opinion, we'll start a conversation on that in our Discord, and please become a patron, join in on that. We'd love to hear from you. And yeah, how maybe your experiences have affected how you played this chapter.
Ooh, and okay. Also, last thing to close out this point is a quote from Kotoko, which is, it's, I think it's said in the scene with this hand stuff. Being adorbs isn't always a good thing. Cute girls go through terrible things. And if you're adorable too, you have to protect yourself on your own. If you can't, you have to take whatever they give you. It's a shitty rule, but I don't make it. Adults did. So be prepared for that life. And the fact that that is what we're drilling in young girls' heads.
I also think this speaks to Kotoko's level of maturity. Not that what she's saying is right, obviously. It shouldn't be like that, obviously. But I think when I've played this game, I've always viewed Nagisa as the smartest one in the bunch. And I think that that isn't necessarily correct. I think that Kotoko is one of the kids who has really had to grow really fast, and unfortunately. And yeah, like she sees what her world is. She's not pretending it's something that it's not. And yeah, I don't know. I think that speaks volume to her character.
Yeah, agreed.
So on a lighter note, when Genocide Jack is battling Kotoko in that same scene, the person that I was watching was playing and they used Fever Time on like the fever attacks. Fever Time. They used the fever attacks to attack Kotoko, and one of them was called Gino's Haircut Shop, where you can get a horrible haircut, and it pictures Kotoko with Leon's hair, like, for a second. Did you not? I was like, what? It's crazy. So,
what I'm hearing is that Leon has bad hair.
Yes, unfortunately, that is what I'm hearing.
Oh my god.
Sorry to all the Leon stands out there. Maddie likes
it. Everyone's looking at me now. Yeah. That's funny. My next note is about the boss battle. I just thought it was interesting how Kotoko's fighter robot was like anything but adorbs. Because, like, that's, you know, being adorbs has been, like, Kotoko's whole thing or whatever. And then her fighter robot comes out. And I don't really know what I was expecting. Maybe, like, something pink. But I definitely was not expecting that, like, big, like, fearsome, like, samurai, like, robot thing. That was just funny to me. But I will acknowledge, it did have floating, like, little pink hearts come out of its hand at one point. So, a little bit adorbs. But, like, I just thought it was perfect, honestly, like more fitting to like probably what Kotoko would have wanted, because I think in a way she doesn't really want to be seen as this like cute little girl anymore, because that's, you know, as she said before in her quote, cute girls go through terrible things. She doesn't want that. So she has this like scary samurai robot come out and try to crush, you know, the people. And yeah.
That little release where she dropped kind of the act of like, I'm so angry, you know, and like acting happy. She really reminded me of Mikan, where it was that shift where it's so scary because normally they're so innocent. Yeah, it really made me sad. Like of all the parts in this chapter, that was the part that made me tear up a little bit, because she was like, then why didn't anyone come save me? And then she puts the facade back on and she's like, that wasn't me. I was acting. And it's like, oh, my heart just broke into 10,000 pieces. Why didn't anyone save her? Like, oh, it was.
Yeah. It's kind of like when Masaru started like beating his own arm. It was that similar effect. It's just like all of a sudden this like oof, like it's just heartbreaking. And then Kotoko has like when she's pulling out the like robot like remote control or whatever, she I think at that point is like having a full-on breakdown and like crying because Toko used like her like trigger word without realizing it, and then that, you know, the effect that has on Kotoko is like really, really heartbreaking.
Kind of on a similar note to like talking about the robot and like how it wasn't very cute, and similar to the quote that Caroline had said, her robot Boom Highlander the Great is a reference to Alexander the Great, who is thought of as one of the strongest military leaders of all time. She is the fighter of the group, and I think that is not simply in like a fun like, oh, someone's the mage and someone's, you know, whatever, but also that she has had to fight her entire life. And so why not pick the strongest fighter, like, or one of the strongest fighters in the world to represent you in battle? Like, I just really loved that.
Going off of that, I've brought up a Jungian archetype for every episode this season for chapter analysis, and Kotoko is no different. But Kotoko is the fighter, which falls under the rebel archetype of the Jungian archetypes. And I just wanted to read out some of these that I thought resonated with her. The core desire of the rebel is revenge. And their goal is to overturn what isn't working. And their greatest fear is to be powerless. And their weakness is crossing over to the dark side, which I thought was really interesting, because I think that, you know, she is skewed in her way of wanting to handle what had happened to her and like getting revenge on all the adults. Yeah, it's been really cool to follow the archetypes as we go along with every character, because, you know, Yeah.
It's like my favorite part of the episode when you bring that up. I'm like, wow.
I mean, they're cool. They're a tool for storytelling, which is why you see them so much in media. Okay, my last note is that Genocide Jack saves Kotoko. And it's interesting because it's for a split second, and then the next cutscene, Toko is back. It's almost as if Genocide Jack came out for 1 second to save Kotoko, and then went back in. And I almost thought of this as like she sees how much pain that this girl is in, and that's when she appeared for Toko the first time, is when she was at her absolute worst and in incredible pain, and she recognizes it when she sees it and understands the suffering, and so that's what brought her out to save Kotoko at the last minute, because she was her only hope in that. So yeah, thought that was kind of interesting that they also Kotoko. Okay, anyway.
True.
Yeah, okay, I'm done.
So this note that I have is just something I noticed from the kind of like YouTube walkthrough that I was rewatching to take notes. And I think this might only be the case for if you're playing this game on PlayStation, but if you get like, you know, sometimes you get, actually, no, I think this is a thing for every console, whatever you're playing it on, but you know, the trophies that you get at the end of the chapter, the one at the end of this chapter is a picture of Kotoko with a quote that says, "You nearly broke my life" on it. And that, I looked that up, and that is a quote from Lolita. The full quote is, "He broke my heart, you merely broke my life." And I have not read Lolita, and I don't really know the context of that quote. Maybe one of you does, but I do know that Lolita is a story about a very young girl and an older man who is a pedophile and is like obsessed with this girl. And it's got very creepy undertones and very, you know, messed up things. And yeah.
I was thinking about looking at Lolita to like come up with some notes for this episode, but I thought, you know, I kind of decided against it because this alone has enough to talk about. We don't need to bring in a whole other story, but yeah, that's really cool and very interesting. Cause I was wondering like throughout when I was playing, I was like, is there going to be a reference? Because this is pretty closely aligned.
One tiny reference at the very end there.
Okay, so my last note that I have is at the end of the boss battle, like the very, very end, when you get that final hit on her robot, she says, "Turning, turning, a swiftly tilting world." And I think it could be a reference to one of two things. The first is a swiftly tilting planet by Madeline L'Engle, who I think wrote A Wrinkle in Time. Okay, cool. But I personally thought it lined more closely with a poem called The Second Coming by William Butler Yeats. And I just want to read some of the lines of this. So it says, "Turning and turning in the widening gyre, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood dim tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand." And like that really spoke to me because one, the line where it says the best lack all conviction while the worst are full of passionate intensity, like the best in this case would be Kamaru, who lacks all conviction, like that's pretty lined up. And then while the worst are full of passionate intensity, that reminds me a lot of Kotoko in this chapter, who is full of just passionate hatred. And then the second coming at hand, I believe in this chapter, when Monica is sitting around that red magic circle, Kurokuma describes her as potentially like the second Junko. And like, so it kind of reminded me of like, I'm losing this battle, but be warned, like the second coming is at hand. And I was just like, wow, this poem is so, yes. Good job, William. Proud of you, buddy.
Oh, William Yeats.
Yeah.
My last like plot summary kind of thing was the pentagram that Monica is like, you know, drawing into the floor and has Junko's face in the middle, but also just noting the fact that Nagisa steps in at the end of the boss battle and decides to let Kamaru leave town
while Kotoko is there watching too.
All right, everybody, we're going to roll into our amended Bedwed Behead this fine eve. And we're going to be picking between Kotoko, Monica, and Genocide Jack, our lovely ladies who are featured in this episode. So, Marin and Maddie, you are going to be deciding who you would rather go to a water park with, go back in time with, and I'll say specifically the Victorian era, or who you would want to go to space with.
Okay, I have my answers.
Please go.
Okay, so part of this is elimination based. Okay, so first of all, water park, Genocide Jack. We see in this chapter that she is able to leap to heights that are unknown to man. So we would not have to wait in a single line. She would just jump both of us up to the beginning of the slide. It would be incredible. Genocide Jack, water park. I would never in a million years make Kotoko go back in time because women weren't as respected as they are today in the olden days. And that girl does not need any more of that. So she's going to space with me. So Kotoko and I, we're going to have a good time. We're going to play some charades. It'll be a blast. Maybe some Uno if we're feeling wild. And then, of course, last but not least, Monica and I will be traveling back in time to the Victorian era. We will be wonders to the world. And yeah.
I actually have the same answers as you, Marin.
Yay!
Yeah, I would definitely, definitely go to a water park with Genocide Jack. She would love it. That would be so fun. I just would be a little scared that she'd like whip out the scissors and like pop the inner tube or whatever on like the water slide or something.
Oh my god!
She just pops in and then we're just like flying off the side of the like big like toilet bowl ride where you're like flowing, like flying back and forth. You just go like yeeting into the sun.
She totally would too. She'd be like, let's make this a little more fun, and then pop in or two.
It'd be fun. That would be a fun time. And then yeah, I also would probably bring Monica with me going back in time, just because yeah I agree with you. I don't think I'd want to do that to Kotoko. And you know, Monica is shrewd, she's manipulative. If we need to like pretend that we're like little peasants, like, and go do, I don't know, like go finagle our way into the palace of wherever, you know, she could do it. She could convince people. I don't know what I'm saying. Kotoko is also shrewd and can manipulate people, but you know, I don't know. That's not important. You know, I just come from a place of like being a little scared to go back in time and like, you know, get arrested and like sent to the gallows for like wearing my socks the wrong way or something. And so I don't know, maybe Monica would be able to help me get out of that situation because she's Monica. Anyway, I would bring Kotoko to space because I don't think I would be able to stand being in like a small like space compartment with either Monica or Genocide Jack for an extended period of time. I think that might be a little dangerous. I'd be a little scared. But Kotoko, I think we might be able to, you know, connect. We might be able to, you know, have some good conversations or whatever. And
you could get in on our Uno game.
I could. Yeah, yeah. Let's all three of us, we're going to space.
Space with Kotoko. So I have completely different answers, actually.
Whoa!
So I would take Kotoko to the water park because I think that girl just needs some fun. And she's going to ride on some slides with me.
Space isn't fun.
Space is fun. But I think that, like, you know, with other kids her age and, like, you know, that kind of thing. And it would be super fun. And I would go back in time with Genocide Jack because heck yeah, that would be the best time travel buddy. And we would be like lesbian gangsters, like in the Victorian era, and like break all the rules and like go and like screw things up and like be wild and chaotic. And it would be so much fun. And then I would go to space with Monica because she, I don't know, just because that's the last one. And I don't know. We could play Uno too. Yeah
true.
She probably knows how to fly a spaceship. I feel like that woman just knows things. Woman, she's a child, you know what I mean though.
It's canon, she can fly a spaceship.
All right, listeners, that concludes this episode. Thank you so much for listening as always. And we know that this episode, you know, included some very, very heavy themes. So if you stuck around for it, thank you. We appreciate you. If you are going through a rough time, or if anything in this episode was upsetting to you to hear, we, you know, are sending our thoughts and our love, and we've got your back. If you, like we said in the episode, if you have thoughts that you'd like to share with us, you can leave us a voicemail at anchor.fm and have the chance to be featured on our podcast. Or if you'd like to send us a voice message with your thoughts, but you don't necessarily want it to be featured, if you'd prefer to just have us hear it or stay anonymous or whatever, that's fine too. You can just let us know. And if you are interested in joining a Discord server with us and talking about these things more and having a chance to, you know, see some bonus episodes of our podcast, consider becoming a patron. The lowest tier is just $2 a month. And we are always enormously appreciative of the support from our patrons. So feel free to join us. Don't forget to follow us on social media. We are Ultra Hope Girls Podcast pretty much everywhere, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. And as always, thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.
Bye. Bye.